Stephanie. We have 5 members of the DD board and 3 members. Four. I was thinking of you in the other capacity, the expo representative. No, we have 4 mental health board members. Do we have a quorum? So the DD board won. Oh, Molly's on. Yeah, okay, but do we have a quorum for the purpose of starting this? Is that?
Yes, you do.
All right.
This is Chandra. I think Stephanie is still on mute.
Okay. So both of the board presidents are here, and the presenter is joining us. So if you two want to get it rolling, I will stop talking.
Okay. It's a joint study session. It's both.
So Ms. Vicki Niswander and I will call the combined CCDDB and CCMHB joint study session to order. Can I get a roll call, please?
Stephanie can't unmute.
Okay. Can you or Leon?
We can. So I'm going to do a couple things. Stephanie can't unmute. Molly is asking if she can roll call from online, which not exactly. We need to do this first and then vote her in. So I'm going to try to do the roll call from memory. Let's see. I email you guys all the time, so I should know. We'll start with the DD board since you're all here. Dr. Susan Fowler.
Present.
Dr. Ann Robin.
Here.
Dr. Kim Fisher.
Here.
Mrs. Georgiana Schuster.
Here.
Mrs. Vicki Niswander. Here. Okay, now I'm going to go to the mental health board. Joe Omosagye.
Yes.
James Brandle.
Yes.
Jen Straub. I know she's not coming tonight. Dr. Lisa Liggins Chambers.
Present.
Okay, I got one. Chris Miner. Yes, he was going to come. But he's not here, but he was going to. Okay. And that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Elaine Palencia. Molly McClay, and we'll get back to her. Okay. And Dr. John Paul Joachim.
Here. All right.
Ooh, so now y'all can vote to let Molly participate.
All right. I will move for a motion to approve for, is it specifically Molly or is it any board member?
You have to do one at a time. Molly has she has one of the qualifying reasons to be able to participate virtually, and you have to go one at a time.
Okay. So I'll move for a motion to approve for Molly McClay to attend the board meeting virtually. We need a second.
I'll second that motion.
Thanks, Jade. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Those in favor have it, so Molly is allowed to participate virtually. All right, and then I guess we'll need a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Sorry, I'm going to put the agenda on the screen for you to
I'll
see.
I'll second it.
All right. Since it's not a budget item, we don't need a
Well, I think we want to put it on the screen just so that the public can see what you're voting on.
Okay,
there we go. So that was Susan, and Susan made the motion?
No.
Oh, Ann made the motion, and Susan seconded?
Yep.
You're too fast for me.
You are. Okay. Okay. There it is.
All right. All those approve, say aye.
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 All those, same sign. All right. Those in favor have it. So we'll move on to citizen input and public participation. All those in the audience may participate. At this time, we'll limit public participation to 5 minutes per person or 20 minutes total. Is there anyone online that would like to make a comment? All right. With that, we'll move on to the chairperson's comments. We'll keep it short since it's going to be a short study session. So, I don't really have any comments. I'm just glad for the warmer weather. I'm sure everyone is too. And hopefully everyone's mental health will improve with more sunlight. So,
where's that warmer?
I don't know. We got it for a little bit and then it went away.
February.
Yeah, right?
I don't have any additional comments.
All right. With that, we'll move on to the study session, which is the Remote Support Services, Empowering Independent Living. We have Kyle Corbin, I'm the Director of Business Development at Safe in Home. And should I just read the whole thing then? Just,
do you mind?
Yeah, no, I don't mind. In his 20-plus year career, he has experience with almost every aspect of service delivery in the intellectual and developmental disabilities field. His background offers a unique perspective when discussing remote support services and community engagement with providers, individuals, and representatives of state agencies. He has held roles in both public and private side of service delivery, and has worked closely with stakeholders in multiple states to develop rules and guidance promoting the use of supportive technology across the nation. He was instrumental in the push to make Ohio the first technology first state and helped dramatically increase the number of individuals using supportive technology nationally. Is there any other comments or additions you wanted, Lynn?
This is Kim. And so I know Kyle through a professional network of mine, of ours. We work together in an interest network or like a special interest group of the national organization called the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disability. And our special interest group focuses on technology and the access and use of technology by people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so actually Kyle has participated in our group and done a lot of work to promote access to technology to help people live more independently in the community through the use of technology. So he also has been instrumental in other states. And Kyle, I hope you'll talk about this a little bit. In other states, actually, and I'm not going to say this correctly, probably, but like approving the use of technology as a fundable support.
Which it's not here.
Right, which is not here. So he's worked with local agencies and across different states and then to get it actually into state policy. So that's why I asked if he could maybe come. So Kyle,
thank you
so much for coming.
I appreciate the invite. Thank you for having me. And you'll get to hear me talk about something I'm quite passionate about. So as mentioned, worked for the Ohio Department of Developmental Disabilities, helped develop this service there, and then moved it out across the country. The way I ended up working back on the private side for Safe and Home was as we established remote support, and I'll go over in detail what that is, and assistive technology as a service in Ohio and really became one of the leaders, multiple states would reach out and ask for assistance with how do we set this up in our state, how can we help serve folks in our state with intellectual and developmental disabilities to connect to this service. And I was spending a lot of time, so much time, working with other states that my boss said to me, you get paid by the state of Ohio to do Ohio work, do Ohio work. And I said, okay, that's fair. So when the opportunity became available for me to do a more on a national scale, I leapt at the opportunity because this is really what I enjoy in assisting different states to how they can set this system up and make it successful. So I'm going to share my screen. All right, so should be seeing a PowerPoint there. With the opening screen. So again, as mentioned in my bio, I've been doing this for over 20 years, it's about 23 years now. And I've worked for the state, I've worked at the county level, I've ran a provider agency, I've started off doing direct care, I've done employment services. So I've touched on a little bit of everything throughout my career. And it does give me a unique perspective when approaching remote support as a new change to how service delivery can occur, because I have had the opportunity to try all the existing models for years and years and years. So let's talk about what remote support is and how we got here and what it is. So we're all aware, I'm certain we're all aware, that we are in the middle of a pretty significant staffing crisis. And this has been an issue. It isn't new. It isn't since COVID. This is actually something that we've been working on for 20 years. But the COVID-19 pandemic really exacerbated the issue, and it has continued from there. So we've continued to see the workforce diminish. We've continued to see the staffing crisis grow and grow, and we know that it's going to be an ongoing issue from here on out. We know that there isn't enough staff available for people that need it. We know that those people aren't coming back, if they were ever there to begin with. We also know that the aging population is growing, and that the intellectual and developmental disability folks are competing with the aging population for the same staff, because they have the same needs. They want to be independent in their home. They need some care. They need some assistance. So all of that is a larger way to say we have to look at how things are being done and then choose a new way, because the existing model just isn't effective anymore. And this is not to say that we should do away with staff. We love our staff. Our staff are the backbone of the industries. We just know there isn't enough staff available to serve all of the individuals that are needed. And I can say with absolute certainty that we have at Safe and Home, and anyone that's utilizing remote support as a service delivery plan, has never replaced a direct service worker. We have not replaced a person. We have just filled the gaps where there is no longer the number of folks to serve that need. And I should have mentioned this before, but I will have time for questions at the end too. So if you do have questions, and I'm sure you will, please feel free to hold on to those, and I'll be happy to go through them one by one. So remote support is a very person-centered process, and it starts with looking at what else is possible for someone and how can we help someone be more independent. Oh my goodness. I even had it on Do Not Disturb. So sorry. My meat is done. I have a smoker going, and it just let me know that it's time to take it off. All right. So what I was saying was that it starts with a request for assistance, right? An RFP goes out, a request for proposal, and that is we've identified someone that looks like, or we think that they might be a good fit for technology services, but we're not sure where to begin, what technology would be a good fit, how it would work together. So at Safe at Home, what we do is we have account executives that are in each state, and they will convene with the team, sit down, and discuss exactly those things. What's important to someone? What's important for someone? The whole process is directed by the individual. If you're familiar with the HCBS settings rule that just went into effect last year, March 7, actually just almost exactly a year ago, after being in development for 9 years, it says that plans have to be driven by the person, that everything has to be that person's decision, what exactly those words, what's important to, what's important for. And so this is a process that the team sits down together and they look at different solutions. So what does that look like? Well, say we're looking at serving Kyle, and we know that Kyle has a few safety concerns. Kyle has a seizure disorder, falls are an issue. We want to make sure that he is safe and if he has a fall, that someone can respond. We also know that at times in the past, Kyle has invited someone into his home that hasn't had his best interest in heart and has done him harm. So we want to ensure that he's safe for that. And Kyle also wants to be more independent in the kitchen, wants to be able to do more recipes on his own, cook his own meals, plan his own meals. So now we've identified things that are important to the individual and things that are important for an individual. And now we would build a service around that using different technology-based pieces. So at Safe and Home, we have about 92 different pieces. Those grow and over time, some we phase out. And those are all sorts of different sensors and items that will do all sorts of different things. And I'll show videos that'll make this make a little more sense, I promise. But say we're looking at that scenario that I talked about with Kyle. And we know that the falls are an issue. So what do we do? So maybe we decide that we're going to put some movement sensors around the home. And these will track, these will be pre-programmed to track movement throughout the house. And if movement isn't recorded, we'll say in 15 minutes we see no movement. That'll trigger an alert for our staff, and we have 24/7 staff that are available. And that staff would then reach out to the individual either through our tablet system or through a cell phone. All of this would be predetermined in the person's plan. And there would be a discussion of, are you okay? Is everything going, yep, I'm just sitting here watching a movie, everything's fine. Or maybe we don't get a response. And maybe in the plan it says you call three times. If you don't get a response in three times, then you move up to the next step on the call tree. So maybe that's mom and dad who live next door. Maybe that's another provider at an agency that is already providing Kyle service. Or maybe it's we directly call 911 when these things occur. All of these things would be pre-planned and would be laid out for the staff person to know exactly how to respond. Maybe we use a Ring doorbell with a set list of who we know are good actors and bad actors on Kyle's behalf. And if we have some folks that we know have done him harm in the past, when someone comes to the door, it triggers that camera. Staff are able to check in, see who that person is, check against the list as to whether or not this person is someone who should be there or not, and then notify Kyle as to, hey, here's who's at your door. What would you like to do? And staff can intervene at that point and say, hey, you know, you're not supposed to be here, or whatever that message is. Again, all these things would be in the plan. And then the third one we talked about, wanting to be more independent in the kitchen. So our services, our staff connect typically through an iPad. We would take that iPad into the kitchen, and maybe I get stuck on midway through a recipe. I can push the button. I can talk to my staff and say, hey, I forget what I'm supposed to do after I put the eggs in. What's the next step? Staff can look that up, walk me through it, and help me get to that next step so that I can move through my day and finish that recipe. So remote support as a whole, it really just is an empowerment system. It's a service. It's not a thing. And it really is designed to help people be more independent in their homes, in their community, at their job. And it just taps into different technologies that are out there to really make this happen and make it possible. Uh-oh. So I've got a video I want to show, and I'll have there's another video that I'll show throughout this presentation too. So yeah, I can talk about it, I can explain it, but it's a little different to have someone actually show you what's going on. So hopefully the sound will work. Just want to double check. Is everyone hearing the sound of the video? Before I paused it.
No, yeah. I think we had a little bit of it before you paused, but it might have been quiet.
Okay, I wonder if I didn't click the... All right, I'm going to stop sharing and then share again, just to make sure that we're all getting what we're supposed to. Yeah. Yes, I'm fairly sure I forgot to click share sound, which is the bane of presenters everywhere. All right, we shall try this again.
My name is Alex Cosma. I am the remote support training manager here at Safe and Home.
All good now?
Yes.
Excellent.
The remote support team is a bunch of people who believe in a very powerful proposition: independent living, dignity, full partnership in the game of human being for everyone that we work with in every capacity, both here at Safe and Home and in life. That proposition gives you a really powerful way of being while you're working with someone. Whatever struggles they may have going on, you know, X or Y or Z happening in their home life, and you get them on the line, it's an opportunity to fulfill on that proposition by being really curious, wanting to know what's going on with them, and leaving them with a sense of, hey, I stand for you and your independence, and I've got your back. If something happens in the home, you can give me a call. You got something on your chest you need to get off? You can give me a call. And there's a team full of people in this building, and they are all here for you in the exact same way. The goal of remote support in general is to help the individuals we support live independently, live lives with self-determination, and live lives with dignity. When we work with somebody on remote supports, we're working pretty much any circumstance in life, whether somebody's in their 20s and living on their first in their first place alone, or in their 30s, you know, living with family, or in their, you know, 50s or older, living with roommates in a home that they share out in the community. So our goal is to meet them wherever they are and help provide services that'll next level their independence and decision making, and give them the skills and support to go from where they are now to where they want to be in a relatively low touch way. They get to experience privacy, doing it for themselves, and knowing that they have the backstop of, if they really run into something, remote supports is there. It's also there for passive things. One of the obstacles to independence may be something like a risk of falls or some other passive danger in the home. Remote supports uses sensors and other electronic tools to help detect patterns of activity and minimize those sorts of risks. My name is Alex Cobb.
So, always better to see a video, see people telling their stories. I'm going to have another video coming up here in a few minutes that tells the story of Brian and how he started his journey and came to remote support. So, as I mentioned before, can't tell you this enough, it's remote support is a service. It's not a thing. Again, it's not replacing humans with technology. It's a trained workforce that uses technology to support people in similar ways to how they're supported in the home, but also in new and exciting ways that help people gain more independence and do more things on their own. So I talked a lot about how we support the person and make it a very person-centered process, and they are driving this service from the beginning all the way through. Every single one of our solutions is individualized. So it's not a, here's a box of technology and good luck to you. It isn't, here's some items that we think you might use and we'll set them up for you and then you're on your own. It is a incorporated service that is billable through the waiver. That's how our service is typically funded, is through 1915C waivers, and all Medicaid. And it fluctuates just like any plan would. So we try some things. If they work, wonderful. If they don't work, let's try something else. And we'll keep working until we get the right mix. It's a supportive environment. It's not directive. It is letting people choose their path at their own speed, at the way that they want to do it. And it really shows a lot of building independence when you look at the data. And, you know, for someone that ran a provider agency for a number of years, you know, I've seen that firsthand as well. If you have someone that will come in, staff will come into your home and do things for you, it's very easy to say, well, why should I do this? I'll let the staff do it. But if that person is not there and it's either I do it or it doesn't happen, all of a sudden we start seeing some skills that maybe no one knew existed all of a sudden pop up. Like, oh, I can do my own laundry. I am doing the dishes. I am cooking my own meals. I didn't have to do that before, but now I'm given the opportunity and the expectation that I should be doing this, that I can do this, and that I will do this. I want to mention again, our staff are available 24/7. So we have two support centers, one in Tempe, Arizona, one in Walnut Creek, California. These are HIPAA compliant environments. Staff have to badge in, they badge out, share data. We use the same encryption methodology as banks do. So there is no shared data that is going out and no one can hack our system and steal data. No one is looking at what's going on in someone else's home. We have supervisors that are there 24/7 to ensure that our staff are doing the things that they're expected to do. Our staff are direct support professionals. They are trained just like staff in the home. Actually, they are trained more than staff in the home because we are in 19 states and each state has some similarities on what training is required, but they also have some differences. And our staff, since they could be getting a call from any of the 19 states, have to be trained to the standard of each individual state. So what do our support solutions look like? Here's an example of some of the things that we can cover. This is certainly not an extensive list. This is just an example. Medication management is one we see quite a bit using med binders or medication towers. And it can be something as simple as an alarm goes off and I know when to take my meds, or it could be as complicated as I need someone to watch me take my meds on camera. And so I will log into through the iPad, talk to staff at my prescribed medication time, and then take my medication with the staff that are there so they can log that. That's extreme. We don't see that very often, but that would be the top level of where people are. And then the next level or the lowest level would be staff reaching out and saying, hey, did you remember at a prescribed time? Overnight support is one we see a lot. That's certainly one where when new states are moving into this service or new providers, often they start there because it's a place where people are often overserved. We usually have staff in the home for just-in-case reasons. We get a lot of just-in-case. And it's easy to look for sites that might be a good fit because they're staffed 24/7 and nothing ever occurs overnight. There's no incident reports. There's no issues. It's just staff that are there doing, whatever the overnight duties are. And so remote support can be substituted in. It's certainly not an all or nothing service. You either have staff or you have remote support. You can have a combination. You can have both. So maybe I have, if we're looking at the 24/7 model, maybe I have 16 hours of staff in my home and I have 8 hours of overnight remote support. Elopement is one we get a lot of questions about. How can we work on this? How does remote support work with elopement? And why do people elope? Well, it's one of two reasons. They are either running towards something to get somewhere or they're running away from something. And often that something could be that staff person in the home. Again, county board, I was a case manager. How many times, for any of you that are case managers or providers, how often is the biggest issue that this individual is having is that they just can't get along with the staff in their home? And quite a bit. Often that can lead to aggression. So now we have an individual that is being aggressive towards staff in the home, and that staff person isn't safe. So what do we do when that occurs? We add a second staff. So now we have two staff that are working with this individual, and now we have doubled the problem, and we're heading in the wrong direction. And that's the model that we've used for 30 or 40 years, and there really wasn't any other good solutions. So utilizing remote support so you ease someone into this, and we've seen this time and time again, is that when we remove that model of having the staff person in the home, that person no longer has a reason to get away from staff. And so elopement goes away, and we see a lot of significant improvements in just day-to-day life, quality of life, and people being able to do their own thing. One of my favorite stories is an individual, exact situation, had two on one staff. He was aggressive. He'd had police involvement. They were looking at potential jail time. They were looking at state developmental centers. Those still exist in Ohio. It just wasn't working for this guy, and he was a danger to himself. He was a danger to others, to staff. And remote support was introduced as an option because the team said, we've got to try something else. This just isn't working. This guy has so much potential. He has so much possibility here. We are failing him. Let's figure something else out. So they started implementing remote support slowly over time, and it went from two staff to one staff and remote support to no staff and remote support. And then eventually he worked himself off. So this was over the course of 4 years. He worked himself off of remote support completely. But before that happened, and while he was being successful, I had the opportunity to talk to him. And I asked him, I said, what is your favorite part of remote support? Why is this so successful for you? Why is this working? And he said, well, I love the remote part. Okay, so you love the fact that staff are at a distance and that you can interact with... No, that's not what I'm saying. What I love is when I come home, my remote is where I left it. Someone is not sitting on my couch watching my TV. I can watch what I want, when I want, and I don't have to listen to someone else tell me to change the channel, which... It's the little things in life, right? Just being able to, or for some people, that's a huge thing, to be able to watch your TV, to just be able to decompress when you get home from work and not having somebody that's right there telling you what you have to do. So that was fun and fun story and eye-opening as to what makes sense for folks. Kitchen safety, we have different things that we can utilize there. Water sensors, if someone walks away and leaves the sink on, we can shut the water off before it overflows. Same with the stove. If I want to cook, but I have the tendency to walk away from the stove or forget that I'm cooking, that it gets to a certain temperature or a certain time where it isn't being adjusted and the stove will shut off on its own. Seizure management. Talked about falls and what that can look like. We also have seizure management wristbands that can identify if someone's having a seizure, a significant seizure. A few other pieces that we can put in place that can alert staff and let people know when something is occurring. Youth transition age. So those folks that are graduating high school, getting ready to move out on their own, whether that's on to college, whether that's into the workforce, perfect group for utilizing technology. They've already been using it their whole lives. They're comfortable with it. Mom and dad are likely comfortable with it as well. It's an easy transition for them to continue to use it to be independent in the home. After school and work support, this is a huge one. When I was trying to fill schedules, is that person who gets home from school at 3 o'clock, mom and dad don't get home from work until 5 o'clock. I need some supervision during that time period, but I live 45 minutes away from town, and I can't get someone to drive, a staff person to drive 45 minutes each way for 2 hours of work. This is a perfect spot for something like remote support where it can fill that gap and fill that role. And I know that I'm turning yellow as the sun sets. Unfortunately, the way my office is, it's just in the windows. So, I can't control the sun yet, but someday. So I told you in another video, this is Brian. Brian lives in Tacoma, Washington, and this is his story as to how remote support's worked for him.
As you can see, my dad's behind me. The present has such the memories of him are still here, and they're in this apartment everywhere. I just miss him. I loved him. I was that close to him. This is the day he died. Practically tore a heart in pieces. And they buried him. So hurts.
Brian was put on the poor waiver for supportive living services when his father passed away. His father was his primary caregiver, and Brian loved him very dearly. And so when he passed away, he was left without anyone to really provide that care he had received his whole life. As can happen with people with disabilities in smaller towns that don't have programs like supportive living, he was put in an old folks home, and that was very difficult for him.
I went my own privacy. I wanted to kill them whenever I wanted without anyone knowing why I was all the time. And that was a constant nightmare. The point where I didn't know I was no purpose.
He was there, from my understanding, approximately 3 years. He fell into a trap that we actually see far too commonly in this line of work, where he was exploited for his funds, but I know it's very painful for him to talk about.
I spent my whole entire life moving me from here to there. All places I moved to, I never, in my whole entire life, I never had a stable place to go. Ever. I never had a single life. I spent a whole year in a hotel before I came to Hope.
So we had gotten his referral here at Hope. And we were picking him up, and I was assigned to be his program manager. Brian told me he had always dreamed about having his own apartment, but he thought it would never be a reality for him. And that got my brain thinking, because I feel like everybody deserves that independence. And so I went to my supervisor and asked, how do we get Brian into the studio? So the problem about moving Brian out of a housemate situation was he wouldn't have staff 24 hours a day. And that would be the first client at Hope to not have staff 24/7. So it was hard. It was a hard sell. But luckily, Safe and Home had just recently put on a demonstration for all the service providers. And Cheryl kind of stepped in and decided she wanted to go with this option for Brian.
They helped me find this place, which is... I was really excited at this time. So, my own place! My own place! Yay! I was so excited.
I think he has gotten to see kind of a new world outside of his little small town, and I think he enjoys that.
Just bring it to... just to be my own, just to be my own self, actually. Here, I'm just free as a bird. I love it, it's so much fun. You just create your own, you know, sleep in my own bed, and just get up and just do the things that I want to do.
It was so exciting to figure out what does he want to do, and the three main things he wanted to do was get a full-time job, learn to drive, find a long-term relationship. And so those were goals that we kind of put in place, these stepping stones to work on.
I work in the freight department at Home Depot. Yeah. I've had it 5 months now. I've never driven a vehicle in my entire life. I've never been behind a wheel. So it's going to be a brand new adventure I'm looking forward to. I have the right equipment to be safe to wherever I was going.
The Geocom is always there, and it always reaches me, and it always reaches Safe and Home, and it's just something that we know will always keep him safe.
Hey, Brian, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's up? How can I help you?
I'm kind of lost. I'm turning around.
Oh, you turned around?
Yeah, right.
Let me look at your location. It looks like you're in downtown Tacoma. Is that right?
Right.
Awesome. Let me get you directions back to the bus, okay?
I appreciate it.
I think having services like Safe and Home available is shaping a whole new world for what services could look like. It's up to us as healthcare workers to take that leap and move these services into a new age, a new era. And it's our responsibility to figure out how do we make sure we are providing the highest level of services and making people's dreams come true.
I highly recommend Safe Home.
I've seen that dozens of times, and it still moves me every time I see it. It's such a really cool story of when people look outside the box at new solutions on how to help someone and how it can have an impact on their lives. So you saw Brian holding his GeoCom. It was that device that looked like a pager with a red button in the middle. And we talked a lot about home safety, but that is also our community safety, and that's a GPS-enabled device that connects directly to staff with the push of the button. And exactly like you saw, hey, I've got turned around. I'm not sure where I'm supposed to go. We see where you're at. We can help you get where you need to be. People have used that at work as well as I'm stuck on a task. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do next. All right, let's look at your list. Okay, here we go. And, you know, he wore it around his neck. You keep it in a pocket. You attach it to a belt wherever you want to keep it. And it just looks like any other piece of equipment. It doesn't single someone out or say, hey, I have a disability. I'm just using technologies like anyone else. So how does our remote support system work? This home here model, you would look at different sensors throughout the home. All of those would talk to each other, and then they would talk to our system in our support center. They would trigger alerts. They would, which may be reasons for us to reach out to the individual or to progress on the call tree, or just to, sometimes we get alerts that are just for documentation purposes to ensure that things are occurring the way they are supposed to. And so it all rolls in together in one proprietary service. So as mentioned, it isn't a separate plan. It's part of the overall existing plan. We're part of the team. We utilize that service plan, and we look at how technology can fit into that existing model and help people become more independent. I talked about our remote support staff, how we're there 24/7, the training that they go to. They're also trained in ACT behavioral techniques. And if you're not familiar, those are non-directive behavioral techniques where the onus is on building authentic relationships and really assisting folks through their day. It's not a, we're going to tell you what to do and when to do it. It is, we're going to work together and look at what next steps are and how we can help you be more independent. One of the great things about our service, once it's in place, say you have someone, we go back to that 24/7 model and we're doing 8 hours of overnight and the person has 16 hours of in-person staff. Staff doesn't show up. You know, maybe they got sick, COVID, they quit, no call, no show. We can cover those gaps. Staff can reach out to us. The individual can reach out to us, case manager, and say, hey, we have a gap here. We need help with this. We can fill that role. So I want to talk a minute about what our documentation looks like, because this is an important piece too. So anytime that we have an alert, whether it's one of the sensors going off or it's an initiated call either by our staff or by the individual, it generates a report. And so our staff then go in and they will document exactly what occurred, what time it occurred, and everything that went along with that. And then those reports are available for the provider agency that may be working with the individual, for the case manager, anyone that would be part of that team that wants to see that documentation, just like any documentation that you would have in the home. And as a provider, again, as a previous provider agency, I know how frustrating it would be when I had a staff person that was working an 8-hour shift with someone. And I would go in to check the logbook, and at the end of the day, and it would say, had a good day. And that would be all that was there. And well, what does that mean? What was this person doing? What did that good day look like? Tell me what happened. So this gives a lot more in-depth detail, and we've used it for some really creative things. Well, I should say teams have used it for some really creative things. Sleep schedule, certainly one of them. If we have sensors that are tracking movement throughout the home, we can see if someone's up and about in the middle of the night, and you know, if they're only in bed for 2 or 3 hours versus, you know, 8 hours, that could be an issue with medication, that could be anxiety, could be a lot of things that can be, the team can then relay that to the physician. Bathroom schedule, if we have, so often what we'll do, obviously we don't put things in bathrooms like cameras or anything. We actually rarely use cameras, but we often put sensors at doors, and you could have someone that has bathroom safety concerns. And so they trigger the sensor when they go in. Sensor set for 15 minutes. If the sensor isn't triggered for the person coming out, staff are reaching out. But that can work two ways. One, to ensure bathroom safety, but two, we can see how often someone's going in and out of the bathroom. And so if they're using the bathroom 12, 13 times a day, we know that could be an issue. And again, those are things that could be sent to the physician for further discussion. So what does remote support look like? So this would be in a state that hasn't established. It starts with that consultation. That consultation occurs again with the whole team. It can be within 24 hours of the time of the request. We have staff that are there in place in state. Our staff, our account executive, will then put a proposal together, and that will incorporate of the discussion that occurred during that. So there's not going to be any surprises. That technology will be incorporated into, here are the needs, what's important to, what's important for. Then it is sent along to either the state entity or the county entity, depending on the state, for approval under that Medicaid service. And once we get that approval piece, then we have the installation. Installation occurs by our staff. We have field service technicians that we train that come out. They know our system. They are trained by us on how to interact with families, with individuals. And they are the ones who will be there to put the equipment in, to train people on how to use it. If something goes wrong, if something breaks, if it needs replaced, those are the same folks that will come out and do the replacement of it. Once that occurs, then service can start. So the biggest piece of this, of course, is education. And you know, was asked is talk more about how states can get involved with this and how they can start it, especially if a state that doesn't have this service already in place. So the first place to start when you're building those rules out, and you know that how long that can take, for the time someone starts the rule process till the time of implementation can be, you know, 2 years, depending on what we're looking at. The easiest way is don't try to create a service specifically for remote support and assistive technology. Tie it to an existing service. So tie it to your direct care service already, and just utilize remote support as a separate way to provide the service that already exists, because it really is the same service. It's just being delivered in a different way. And when states approach it with that mindset, it makes life a little easier when they're going to CMS and saying, hey, here's what we would like to do, and here's the budget that we would like to attach to it. And two, it makes more sense for providers, for individuals and things. They're not trying to learn something new. It's just, we're just going to do staffing. We're just going to do it a little different. So that's one key component to it. Then the second one, of course, is ensuring that there's an actual workable budget that's attached to it. So whether it's attaching it to that existing service and tapping into that current budget, which some states do, or it is creating a separate billing line item for that service delivery. Our cost, of course, is important with anything in life, right? Even whether it's buying something or serving individuals. What our standard rate is, we actually have a couple different rates depending on the states and how they are set up. But we operate our remote support service at $9 an hour, and then plus the cost of assistive technology equipment. So if you look at what the cost is for in-person service delivery, we're usually about a third to a quarter of what the cost is for that service. So it's much more affordable. We also have a all-encompassing model that we utilize in states that set an overreaching budget. So you look at Ohio, for example. They remote support is at $8.99 an hour. and AT equipment is billed at the manufacturer's suggested retail price plus 30% for installation, delivery, repair, training. It's all kind of laid out in their rule. And then there's an additional allowance of $75 per month per item for things like subscription fees to keep things up and running. So that's one model. Then there's another model. You look at like a Maryland, for instance, and they have a $64,000 annual budget for technology-based services. And in a state like that, we will charge $13 an hour for remote support. But that also includes any technology that goes along with that to make it functional. So it does make life a little cleaner. It stops some of the conversation between case manager and, is this piece of equipment needed? Did you add this unnecessarily? Because there's always questions, because there's so much equipment out there that no one could possibly know at all. So being a good steward of public money, the expectations, questions are asked. So going through that process sometimes can bog down when we start from having service requested to when it's actually approved. But using that combined model erases any of that and can really speed things up. Education is the key. We're looking at a culture change. We're looking at serving people in a way that they have not been served before. This is a service model that pretty much didn't exist before 2017. So it's still brand new. It's in its infancy. We're, as I mentioned, in 19 states, we're serving about 2,500 people across that. So when you look at the 1.8 million folks that are on some form of 1915C waiver, that's just, you know, barely scratching the surface. And there's about three other companies like us that are national. We all do things a little different, but we're all friends. And so we share a lot of information. But it really is just kind of really scratching the surface of what can be done. So if you want to use that QR code link there, that will link you to our YouTube page. And there are some more videos like Brian's video or the overview with Alex Cosma that I showed early on. But some really great stuff there, just people out there living their lives using technology. And it really kind of walks through what it looks like and how it all works together. So really appreciate you guys having me and having this discussion. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have and or any other discussion points that you'd like to talk about.
thank you, Mr. Corbin, for the presentation. I think, you know, a lot of us would love to see something like that in Illinois. Obviously, we have a severe shortage of DSP workers, staff, because of many reasons. Obviously, financial is one of the biggest issues of just not being able to pay them an adequate wage. With the model that you guys have, one of the questions I was wondering was how do you guys pay your employees more so that they are able to staff these positions? Because isn't it typically mandated by the state how much you can pay the workers? And so is it just that Arizona and California, where you're located, allows you to, I assume it's through each individual state, so each of the 19 states will have a dictated amount of how much you can pay each employee. Like, how do you pay your workers more so that you can have adequate staffing? Mm-hmm.
It's actually so dictated by the state that they're working in. So since our folks are located in either California or Arizona, we actually pay a much higher model than you would have for in-person staff. And that typical reimbursement rate is. The model, that service model. So we're able to utilize one staff to serve multiple folks. If you go into one of our service centers or any of the service centers of anyone that is providing this service, you would, if you think call center, you're wrong. Because that's always the first thought is, oh, it's just going to be hectic. It's not. It is people just living their lives, and we're just there to support when needed. So oftentimes it's very quiet, and then you have interactions just like we're having right now, and checking in, seeing how things are going, and then they move on. So one person may only have direct interaction with an individual 3 or 4 times a day. So they can serve multiple people over that period of time. And so volume-based, it allows us to pay staff at a very competitive rate. And boy, I love the opportunities to go out to the call centers. One, just to sit in and watch how those interactions are and have a chance to talk to the folks that we're serving. But two, that they have unlimited snacks in their break room. It's like you open that refrigerator and it's nirvana. Like there's, do you like pop? We got them all. Do you need an energy drink? Got all those too. Are more health conscious? How about some fruit juice? Right? Like there's anything that people want plus just piles and piles of snacks. And they get a DoorDash, daily DoorDash allotment. So if you want to bring in, have lunch delivered. So yeah, they're spoiled. They really are. They're treated very well. And for that reason, our turnover is very low at our support centers.
That's excellent. I'm not as familiar with DSP work, and I was just curious, how many individuals does a typical employee usually care for versus how many individuals does one of your typical employees oversee?
So it really depends on the needs of the individual, right? Whether it's in person or via remote support. So you may have situations where you have one staff that are working one-on-one with someone. Very often, though, you'll have staff that are working 1 to 4 or even 1 to 6 in some situations. I would say that 1 to 2, 1 to 4 model is probably a little more common. Of course, the problems that you run into with that are numerous. You know, if I'm working with 4 folks and somebody, and you know, Kyle wants to go to the store, but Bob doesn't want to go to the store, and we both have to have supervision. We're either all going to the store or nobody's going to the store, right? Like, so, I mean, we run into those problems, and those are not new. So looking at the remote model, what does that look like? Well, it depends on, same thing, needs of the individual. Do you have someone that requires more time and attention from the staff? If so, that they're going to have a lesser caseload. And it also depends on time of day. So 7 a.m., a lot of calls, a lot of people getting up, ready for work, starting their day, medication reminders, different things going on to ensure that everything is going smoothly with that person as they get up and get ready. 5 o'clock in the evening, very similar. So you're going to have a much smaller staffing ratio of individual to staff. 3 in the morning, not much going on. So people are going to serve at a much higher ratio. And so that's all really built into our scheduling model as we plan out the days and weeks.
I appreciate all this information. It's there's just so many questions. I'm sure other people have a lot of questions they want to ask you, so I'll open it up to everybody else.
And Kyle, I'm sorry, I'm probably not going to be able to get my camera right on them, so you'll hear voices.
Okay.
People in this room, I'm sorry. But we can see you. You look great.
This is Vicki Nicewander. I have a question for you that should be a quick answer. Do you provide services in Illinois anywhere currently?
Not currently. So we come to states as they're ready for us, right? And so some of that is, do you have rules and regulations in place that allow for this service to be delivered? Is there a budget available?
Yeah.
So that's one of my roles is not only to navigate the red tape behind becoming a partner with the state and being a provider agency in that end, but also working directly with the heads of the state when they're building this service out, because it is something that I've done in the past, and I'm always happy to just pass along any information, offer suggestions. Some states are very happy to talk with me. Some states are like, no, we got this. We don't need you. So it really depends on the state and who's in charge. But yeah, unfortunately, currently not in Illinois at this time. But I will say there are three kinds of states. There are ones that are currently using this service and using it well. The second kind is those that are just getting started with it. They have rules and regulations in place. They have a budget. They're right on the cusp. And the third is the ones who are getting ready, because there really is no alternative. The in-person staffing model just isn't able to continue the way that it has in the past.
Hi, Corbin. It's Lisa. I have a couple of questions, but I'm not going to dominate all of the questions, but I wrote like a couple of questions on each slide. So interrupt me if you all have questions. No, don't put the camera on me. I'm fine. No. Okay, so first, I'm an Ohioan, so I'm really happy to share that with you.
Wonderful.
Yeah, are you an Ohioan awesome. As well?
Oh, yeah.
O-H.
I-O,
my man. All right, let's talk about the criterion, you know, those that you take for this wonderful service. I hear you saying developmental disabilities. Does that include adults with autism?
It certainly does, yes. Anybody with an intellectual developmental disability. We're actually also, in some states, looking at how we can work with them to increase this to the aging population as well. But yeah, anyone that qualifies and has waiver services, we do some private pay, but that's rare.
It's almost as if you can read my mind, because I was going to ask you about the elderly. So you already answered it.
Yeah, there's a few states that have started that process. Oklahoma actually has people on service and are moving forward with it and very successfully. Colorado and Washington have language in their and their waivers for the aging population to use it, but they haven't taken that step to getting somebody on yet. And then Ohio, Indiana, and someone else, Tennessee, have discussed how to get those next steps and get that there. It's funny. So I worked for the Ohio Department of Developmental Disabilities for a number of years, and every year without fail, I would have a meeting with the Ohio Department of Aging, and they tell us again about this remote support service. And I'd give them the presentation and go over through it. And they go, this is wonderful. This is great. We're really going to get this moving forward for our population. We'll get back to you every year.
Well, we like it in Illinois. speaking of the waiver, you mentioned the $9 and some of the breakdown of the payments. Is that all covered by Medicaid or Medicare? Medicaid, right?
It's Medicaid, and it is through waiver. So the 19, most states have 1915C waivers. There's other letters that go in there as well. But yeah, for those folks that have those waivers, it is all covered through that. It depends on the budget of the state, but it is an allowable service.
I'm Susan Fowler. I'm going to ask a question about Illinois, and I'm sitting here and just dreaming about how wonderful this service would be for my son. We have something called a home-based waiver service, which mm-hmm. is for individuals with intellectual disabilities, autism, et cetera, who have qualified through the state through what's called persons with urgent need of support. Mm-hmm. And so I have a son who qualified 7 years ago. And we do have trouble finding people to provide enough services for him. His favorite service, which had to end when we went to the electronic verification visit system at the state level, and I'll explain that, is he loved being on the computer and having long conversations about issues that he was trying to problem solve with a couple of his providers. He clammed up if they were in the living room, but he could do it through remote. And I have been told explicitly and reprimanded when I attempted to charge hours and they couldn't verify they were in his home.
Yeah.
Because it's a GPS identifiable verification system. So
I am not using very much of my home-based waiver right now because they will not allow any kind of remote service. And probably the problem solving has been more effective at keeping my son safe at home, making good decisions, than having someone in the house. In fact, he often won't answer the door when someone comes to quote unquote help him clean. He'd rather just have someone giving him a task analysis and staying away. But I don't know how to deal with the state and how to get the state to think more broadly. I just had a conversation a week ago with IDHS when I fired a person who had not been showing up but had been able somehow illegally to submit hours. And the state said, well, that's your problem. And I said, no, I want to fire him. He knows he's being terminated because he's not providing direct support. He's not even providing telephone support. And they said, well, you can't provide telephone support. So here I was in the middle of this situation where someone wasn't showing up, was billing hours, and the state just won't even consider. So, you know, they finally agreed that I could fire this person, but they won't consider the remote support. And I'm, you know, I was about ready to just say I don't want the waiver anymore because I'm not using it. So how do we go about in Illinois looking at technology-supported services? I mean, telepractice is happening in all kinds of health systems, but it's not happening in our system, DD system.
And it's a mindset, right? Like it is a wrapping they're wrap their heads around the fact that there's a different way to do service delivery. And it has to start at the top, whether that's all the way at the governor level, whether that's at the director of DD services. But someone at that level has to say, hey, this needs to be successful. And it needs to be conversations from, you know, families, parents such as yourself, they're saying, we need this. The current system is failing us. We need a different approach to how this can be delivered. We need you to look at what other states are doing and adopt that model. And you can even show them or tell them, and they can find out for themselves, this is a cost-effective model. That was how it started in Ohio. It was, we knew that the current system was going to fail because of overtime and the reimbursement rate for provider agencies and the inability for them to keep doors open because of cost margins were so thin. And technology was looked at as, well, maybe this is some way we can serve people cheaper. And as we dug into it and realized, oh my gosh, this is just a better way of serving people and it provides more independence, that whole shift pivoted into, we're going to do this because it's the right thing to do. And it just happens to benefit everyone involved because it's also a cost savings. So yeah, that has to be driven upwards to get the attention and say, hey, you have to do it. I have a lot of conversations at the state level with numerous states for exactly these same things and reasons. I spend time at national conferences talking to different state level employees, director level, and I unfortunately have not had the opportunity to speak with anyone at that level for Illinois. But push that service up, let them know that it's there, and demand different ways of service delivery.
Thank you. I'm looking at some of my colleagues on the DD board and hoping that maybe we can come up with a way to get this information into the system because they're just so resistant. I'm also looking at Lynn, who's pretty effective. But yeah, thank you.
And I'm not certain of the structure in Illinois, and I apologize for that. But, if you have county board associations, that can be a great place to push that up to the state level. Provider agency organizations, because your providers are drowning out there. They don't have the staff. They don't have the ability to continue to pay overtime. They need a life preserver. Getting them on board and pushing it up and saying, hey, we demand a change, that can be helpful.
when somebody is receiving remote support, it's $9 an hour. Is that 24 hours a day, 365 days a year?
The price doesn't change. It doesn't matter what time it is, what part of the day it is. Yeah, that often you see a lot of models that bill in 15-minute units. Yeah, it's significantly cheaper than in-person service delivery. But, 24/7, 365.
Yep.
So just as a quick follow-up, I think in Illinois right now we're stuck with a system where you get a certain amount of money per month through this home-based waiver, and they don't really care if you pay someone $50 an hour or $15 an hour. You just get that $2,500, $2,700. That's it. And regardless of whether or not you need more services, that's what's available. You work within that budget.
Sure.
And this remote support would be almost $80,000 a year.
But not everyone would need 24/7, 365 days a year.
True, but you don't know when they're going to need it necessarily.
But I think there are a lot of individuals who have made progress in living independently who just need a certain number of opportunity hours, maybe.
We may have two or three people in out of that 2,500 that are 24/7. Like, it's rare. It's very, very rare. Typically, what we have is maybe 4 hours, 6 hours of a set time period. But often what we have is a few hours and then we're available, right? So if you don't need someone monitoring you continuously over a period of time and you just need to have maybe a reminder call at 6 o'clock or at overnight, I want to be able to push a button. So here's a great example. Someone woke me up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was a noise. I'm not sure what's going on. I'm afraid someone's in my home and I need to talk to somebody. So instead of calling 911, I can push the button, talk to staff. We can check the sensors to see if there's any movement in the home. There's nobody there. Everything's good. Everything's still locked. You know, you're in a good spot. So that's a 1 minute call that you know you wouldn't bill hours for, right? So that's part of our service. It's just really included into our service. If you're receiving, 4 hours a day, you have that ability to push that button anytime and say, hey, I need to talk to someone.
Just for for a group discussion, I think the $2,500 a month, if you spread it out, it'd be around a little over 6 hours at $13 an hour. If you didn't want to pay for like the technological equipment up front, that'd be about a little over 6 hours a day that it would cover for. So
what'd you come up with?
About it's like 6.2, 6.3 hours per day at $13 an hour per month. So 6 hours a day, you would get covered for that 20. Like if you use that $2,500 for that cost, you would cover a little over 6 hours a day of DSP. So,
if you used it all, you would probably more likely use 2 hours a day, and then utilize that other money for direct service providers to do things like take me out into the community, or help me get back and forth to work, do pre-employment services. Job coaching, whatever else is incorporated into that budget. So, again, we're just part of the piece, right? We're just a tool that would fit in there and where it makes sense.
I do want to ask, I'm only going to ask one more question. I can look at your website and try to figure out, you're laughing, and figure out the rest of my questions. But I do want to ask about ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. You said that your staff is trained based upon that model. I was just curious, who's training them? Is that person certified or licensed in ACT?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, we utilize licensed trainers. When we first started, we had reached out and had them supply someone for us. And then as we've gotten bigger, we have had our own trainers in-house.
Gotcha. Thank you, Buckeye.
All right.
Any other questions, comments? Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Corbin. This is Dr. Joachim. This was very informative. You know, it gives us a lot to think about and hopefully also hope for the future. Hopefully our state will be one of the next ones to adopt something like this in the future, sooner rather than later, I hope. Thank you so much.
I do want to answer the question that was in the, I see that there was one in the chat about delegated nursing services. So, excuse me, we don't employ nursing services, and so we're unable to do any kind of delegated nursing service. We can do some assisted medication. Again, it depends on what the needs are of the person. It could be something, as, like I mentioned, simple as just giving reminders, verbal reminders, or we can watch someone take their pills to verify that they were taken. But yeah, we're not able to do any other delegated services. Thank you so much for letting me sit in on your group for the evening. And very much pleasure. If you have questions, please feel free to share my information. You can reach out to me anytime. I'm happy to answer anything that you have that you think of later on.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kyle.
All right. With that, we'll move on to agency input. Is there any agencies out there that would like to make any comments? Now is the time. We'll leave it up to 5 minutes per agency.
And we have an agency person in the room.
Oh, perfect.
To put on the spot. Might not have it.
There you go.
It's a very weird looking one.
Yeah, very
weird. Hello. My name is Josh. I work for a developmental services center here in town. I don't specifically have any questions about this service. It is fascinating. It'd be terrific to have something like this in Illinois at some point. I can say at DSC we are working toward a lot of these things in increasing and changing the supports that we offer. Unfortunately, it's trying to get the state to keep up with us that, you know, is the big problem. So, yeah. But I guess that would be my comment for the night.
All right, thank you. Any board announcements or input? All right, saying, we have one here.
Thanks, Dr. Joachim. Just thank you for everybody to come, and thank you for coming and listening to this presentation.
Can I have a quick thing? Okay, so this is my board comment. May not be 100% acceptable, but Mike Ingram, you might know, has the last couple of years helped sponsor the great CU prom giveaway. So several of us are volunteering this weekend to pick up dresses, jewelry, shoes for ladies and gentlemen. And then what we do is we allow these young folks to come in free of charge. They get what they need for prom night. And it gives me goosebumps talking about it. So if you see any of the posts, there are drop-off locations. Again, pretty much any of us, if you say swing by my house, here's the address, I think any of us will swing by and get it. And it's one of the most rewarding things that I've done, and I will kid around a little bit with Mike. Him and I are polar opposites politically, but I absolutely love working with Mike on this event, and I've met some really great people. So if you see the post and, you know, you can donate, it would be much appreciated, and share it with any young folks. You know, it is free of charge.
That's great. With that, I'll move to adjourn. All right. See you guys next month.
Recording.